Music, among other things.
Music among other things.
Music among other things.
Hey everyone, I'm Sean.
And I'm Neil.
Welcome to Music Among Other Things, or MEOT for short, where we chat to musicians and creators about music and the worlds that orbit it. And we've got a pretty special episode today, Neil, haven't we? What are we talking about, man?
We have.
What's going down?
So yeah, we're going to be talking about the album from Arctic Monkeys, Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino. It's an album that certainly splits opinion amongst a lot of fans. Yep. So yeah,
and
it's a good one. And us, yeah. A few shots fired in this one, so.
So, full transparency, we did try and get this out in line with the third anniversary of Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino, which was back in May, but life got in the way and we had to push it back a bit, but still here for you guys to enjoy now. We're also joined by a third party. We're joined by Sophie Williams, who writes for Enemy, The Guardian, DIY Magazine, among other things, and she's a self-confessed Arctic Monkeys aficionado, so we sort of have almost like a round table conversation. Obviously, Neil's more on the sort of dislike sides. Me and Sophie, we're more on the sort of love side of Tranquility Base. But Sophie compiled the Enemy list, which was the Arctic Monkeys songs ranked in order of greatness. So essentially every single song in their back catalogue. So we get into that a bit with her as well. Also, it was good to see you, Neil, over the weekend. First time in a long time.
It was.
I was also wondering how the Olivia Rodrigo addiction is going. I think you said you were down to like 8 plays yesterday.
Yeah, I've only sent her 20 invites to the podcast. down to about 8 plays yesterday. I think that was just an exaggeration. But no, it's a deja vu. It's a good tune. It's just got me. So yeah, it's one of those when I'm hooked to something, I will just listen to it until I'm physically sick of it. But it normally takes a good 2-3 weeks of that. So I'll be done with it shortly. But yeah. And then it'll be absolutely
just be
dead
another
to me.
Song.
Yeah, but it's a very catchy tune.
I was actually just looking up whether like music addiction exists. And all the experts say like technically no. Because basically an addiction is only bad if it actually has a negative consequence, but music is always like good. But if it was bad, these are some of the questions you need to ask yourself if you have a potential addiction. So answer these candidly. Can you control the behavior pattern of listening to Olivia Rodrigo's Deja Vu?
Yes.
Does it cause problems in your daily life?
Yes.
Do you continue the behavior despite any negative consequences because you feel unable to stop? There's no really negative consequence, though, is there?
No.
Unless your girlfriend gets annoyed.
No, I just... it's a lot in the shower. I probably get about 6 plays alone in the shower. 2 when I'm cooking, maybe 1 if I'm doing a rare spot of gardening.
And then the last question is, do you need the behavior more over time and experience withdrawal when you don't engage in it?
I wouldn't say withdrawal because it's always in my head. I'm just singing it anyway.
Yeah. It's literally like deja vu, man.
Whoa. Well, it's good to hear that. It doesn't seem like you have an addiction.
No.
But I hope keep us updated on where that's going. But so this is the first in a new season. So we've got a really great season prepared for everybody. And so keep your eyes out in the coming weeks, essentially, for other episodes going live, which will be on a Thursday. Follow us on MAT Pod on Instagram and Twitter. It's been another anniversary for Arctic Monkeys this week because there's a 10-year anniversary of Suck It and See. And Sophie's also written a really good piece around that. But I've put any links to the articles in the show notes. And yeah, enjoy. So we are joined by Sophie Williams today. So obviously to get into this Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino special. Sophie writes for Enemy, The Guardian, DIY Mag, The 45, Guitar. And your bio reads, I'm a 20-year-old arts writer, Arctic Monkeys aficionado, and father John Missy Stan from Cardiff, Wales. Does that about sum it up as an intro?
Yeah,
That's about as much as it is, really. Yeah, I did a good job.
Excellent. So Sophie took on the mammoth task of ranking every single Arctic Monkeys song in order of greatness for NME back in December, which included like B-sides and rarities, which is why we got you on to talk about Tranquility Base and get into this this special. So I think, first of all, like, that's quite a mighty task to actually rank everyone.
That actually gives me anxiety thinking of that.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
And it's a band that obviously invites a lot of opinion when you start ranking stuff, but how did you go about ranking it? And, you know, what was the sort of process there, if there was any?
It's definitely kind of been a joke online and amongst a lot of my editors of the past years that I am an Arctic Monkeys obsessive and a little bit overboard at times. So I kind of made a joke on Twitter about one day doing this listicle. And a couple of days later, the tweet was received so well that a couple of days later, I thought, no, I'm actually going to go out and do this. So I originally pitched it to coincide with 15th anniversary of whatever people say I am, that's what I'm not. But the editor ended up asking me to see if they could get it in at the end of the year. So essentially I was kind of left to my own devices, and overnight I just got in the zone and put my playlists on and just ranked them without trying to look back too many times, because I thought if I go and do that, I'll start overcomplicating it, right? So and then I was given about a week to try and do all the copying myself, double check to all the order myself. And at the time I was leaving my previous role as well, so it was a little bit chaotic. But yeah, I consider it to probably be the best piece of work I've done so far, so I'm still proud of it.
It must have been fun to do as a proper Arctic Monkeys fan, you know, just to go through that. I mean, did you get much like pushback from fans and stuff? Did you get people weighing in and everything?
Oh, yeah, loads. I even had people that found my personal Facebook account and were messaging me on there. And to be honest, it was all in jest. I found it quite funny that there wasn't anything too bad. But if you go and look out there, there's threads on Reddit, there's Twitter threads, people picking up. And they actually decided to tweet the article again about 2 weeks ago, and the whole cycle started up again. People commented me on Twitter, and I was just like, I don't think I'll ever be allowed to rest now. Like, this is going to be my legacy.
That's going to stalk you.
Yeah.
It's literally impossible. Like, to be fair, there probably is that one person out there who's got the exact order you have, and they're like, yeah, she got it right.
Yeah.
And that's all you get. And then all the rest, it's just so much easier to hate on something, isn't it? You just disagree.
I mean, like, they're such a popular band that any order that I could have put out there would have been polarizing.
Exactly.
There wouldn't be one perfect order, and there's such an expansive back catalogue as well that you can't order 100 songs in one particular way and expect everyone to be happy. So it was a really, really tricky job, but I think I did okay.
Yeah, I think so as well. I think it speaks to the quality of the music as well, that the fact that everybody's would be different. I think that speaks to how much they've changed up over the years, which I've always really appreciated. I'm also curious, because I'm aware you're a little bit younger than us, and as you're such a massive Arctic fan, because I mean, I think from my perspective, sort of this was around like high school, so I probably got into them around like Favourite Worst Nightmare properly. Neil, I imagine your brother might have put you onto it from uni or something.
No, it wasn't actually. He wasn't a massive fan. It was, I think it was my DT teacher.
Oh, really?
Mr. Gray. Big up, Mr. Gray. I think he was the running assembly when I was about, I must have been about, 13, 14? And he was just saying, like, he's really looking forward to this debut album coming out by a band called Arctic Monkeys. Everyone was just like, okay.
No way.
Like, yeah, and he was really, like, one of those. He followed them from the start. So, and then since then, I just checked him out. And then, saw him live in, I can't remember where, 02, I think. Just like when you used to travel to London from quite far away for a gig, it used to be quite a big deal. Yeah. And just fell in love when I heard their music.
Yeah, big up the DT teacher. So when was it for you, Sophie? Because, what era did you get sort of snapped up in anyway?
It was probably around Suck It and See. So I was actually 10 years old when that album came out.
No
but
way! Because 10 years old this year, isn't it? Oh my God, yeah.
No. Oh God. That makes me feel old.
So that's, to be fair, that's quite a cool thing for a 10-year-old to be into, though, I'd say.
Yeah, it was from a family friend who played them quite a lot. She played a lot of Humbug stuff. And around the time, I guess like many other teenagers that grew up on the internet, I was on YouTube quite a lot. So I kind of took it on myself when I was like 10, 11, when I had like my first iPod Touch, to kind of go back and watch their old videos, play their old songs. And kind of throughout my early teenage years, when Spotify kind of first became big, did the same thing there, made my own playlist with all their songs. And then I think when I was about 14 or 15 years old, that's when, I don't know, something just clicked. And I couldn't tell you how. I decided that this band was basically going to ruin my life, essentially. And I just started to read like all their articles, all their cover features. And from there, decided that I wanted to write about music myself, because obviously I had this image of my favorite band in my head, and I was seeing how all these other writers were writing about them, and thought, like, that's what I want to do. I want to write about something I'm so passionate about. So, yeah, they were a huge, huge part of my teenage years, and I don't think that's ever really going to change.
That's really cool. You must, I reckon you must have been a proper trendy hipster 10-year-old.
Oh,
cool kid.
No, I was so shy and awkward, but I think they were just kind of a, not sound cliche, but escape, you know?
Totally. Because I remember, like, I think Humbug was the first album I was, like, properly excited about coming out. I remember, I think my mate, do you remember, well, way back when the albums used to leak a few months ahead of time? Sometimes I think that Humbug one leaked, like, maybe a month ahead of schedule. And my mate had it on his laptop, and I was like, oh, I don't want to, like, ruin it. So I just got into playing the first, like, 10 seconds of every song. And then eventually I gave in. And I think we went on holiday, and I like deleted it from my iPod to try and forget it, and then that didn't work. It was just weird, but I remember being like so excited when Humbug came out, for sure.
But do you remember when AM came out, and it was like a month before or something short, and you were around mine at uni, and all we had was a track listing, so we were just looking at your phone at these tracks, and we were like looking at the track names, being like, "How do you reckon this is going to sound? How do you reckon this is going to sound?" I think all we'd heard by then was like,
Do I Want to Know? And Are You Mine, I think.
Yeah, I think it's Why Do You Gonna Call Me When You're High or something. But
yeah.
And it was just, that's all we kind of knew the sound. And we were just like, speculating over each song for about 3 hours, what each one was going to sound like. And then it came out, we're like, I didn't think Knee Socks was going to sound like that. Why are we trying to predict it? Like
we're going to have a say. I don't know. But so Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino has been, so it's, come on, it's the third year anniversary of it. Does it feel like 3 years to you guys?
Not at all.
It doesn't,
not
does it?
At all. No.
I think it feels longer for me. I don't know why. Yeah. I don't know why, but it just, I don't know, maybe because I'm not the album's biggest fan, but
yeah,
it's just ingrained.
I think that's the key thing to mention, which we're getting to now. We've got like a sort of round table of opinion here. obviously, Tranquility Base is, you know, it's a record that really splits opinion, and certainly splits the opinion of the people on the episode here today. And we're going to have some people dropping in with voice notes as well. But first of all, what were your, let's maybe start with Sophie first. Like, what were your first impressions of the album when you hit play, and did you sort of wait it out to listen to the album in its entirety? Because as you recall, they didn't put any singles out beforehand. They wanted to put the whole thing out as one. But yeah, what was your first impressions, and you know, how did you listen to it first time?
Well, it did actually leak a couple of days before, but I avoided that because obviously, as such an avid fan, it was such a big deal for me, and we'd waited so long since AM that I didn't want to ruin that listening experience in any way. So the first time I listened to it was on vinyl the night before the official release, because it arrived early. And I think I was just really overwhelmed, to be honest. There was a lot going on Twitter. There was obviously all the cover features that came out that week. And I was still quite young when AM came out. So this album was kind of the first chance that I had to really kind of invest in my Arctic Monkeys fandom, if that makes sense. Like, I was kind of finally old enough to join in on social media and kind of go out and buy the record myself. But I think the first kind of few observations I took from it was that it's definitely the densest album to date. It's quite a heavy listen that definitely took me a few times to come around. But at the same time, I kind of saw it as a band that was finally a little bit more loose, having fun, and kind of even willing to take the piss out of themselves at some point. That was definitely the first thing that shone through to me, and I think that was reflected in the live shows later that year as well.
Yeah, definitely. Because I did the same thing where I wasted it out because I was like, I've waited for so many years for this. Why ruin it with a leak or a live video or anything like that? And I specifically remember because I had the vinyl delivered the day before as well, and I had it, you know, you have those pickups, and it was a pickup at some cycling shop on this random roundabout, and I went there after work, and the guy couldn't find it for about, I think I was there for about an hour almost just waiting for him to find it, because he kept going into the back room and he had to come back and serve a customer because they were in there for like some cycling gear or something, and then he'd go back, and I was like, I've been waiting so long for this album to come out, just waiting for the time to pass. And then he eventually found it in the most annoying spot, just behind the door frame or something. And I was like, oh my God, like another hour has gone by. And then I think I did the same thing. I put the record on, and I guess this would have happened a lot in the old days, because I hadn't really done that before where I had just put the record on to start with, but I accidentally had it on 45 instead of 33. So I just heard all this like high pitched stuff. And I was like, I'd read some press, like, I knew they had gone out there, but this is something really wild. But yeah, I remember that as well, just thinking, as I'm sure a lot of people, you know, did think, you know, it's very, like you said, dense is a good word for it. Also, just the way that the, because I think, especially on AM, you know, the lyrics fell in such a nice way that sort of resolved with the bass and the drums and everything like that. And the lyrics are usually so sharp, but this time you just sort of let it loose. So it's sort of quite hard to follow on that first time. And then I think, yeah, by the time I've given it a few listens, that's when you can really unwrap it. And I think for me anyway, it's something that I've been able to enjoy over the longest period of time, and I'm still finding joy in listening to it now. Whereas with AM and the albums before, I've played it so much that, you know, you can tend to sort of run it out quite quickly. But but those were two sort of happy incidents, and I've got a feeling that when I ask Neil, it's going to take a darker turn.
No, this is what I need. Need Rich, who couldn't make it today, who's also not the most hugest fan. No, I don't hate the album. I think I had I was already in a bad mood when I was first listened to it, because I pre-ordered it with Domino Records, all happy, waiting with everyone else. So glad to hear yours arrived day early, by the way. Good for you. And then, yeah, it came, I think it was a day late, which, as you can imagine, so annoying, because I was so excited. And I remember like tweeting, got the tweet here in front of me, and I remember tweeting really angrily. May the 14th, I've got, so apparently ordering next day delivery on a Tuesday morning isn't enough time for an album to arrive on Friday. I've only just received my record when told via email that I'd have it on Friday. All I want is a refund for the delivery charge. Explain yourself, Domino Records.
just so you know, Sophie, Neil had a tendency to really go off at like brands on Twitter. He's one of those guys.
That is essentially what I use Twitter for, is to not to rant, but when things go wrong in my life, maybe it's to get my refunds and so I think I was already kind of, that already miffed me, I think, maybe. So when I put it on, maybe I wasn't in the best headspace, but I don't know. I think for me, I felt like it was the first time. It was the first time Arctic Monkeys used their kind of reputation in making an album, I think. I feel like if they release this album, or if a random band released this album, I wouldn't remember it a couple of months down the line. And I think Arctic Monkeys, it was the first time where they had the opportunity, which is great, by the way. They had the opportunity because of how good they are and how successful they've been up until that point, to release something like this, to be a bit bold, which I totally respect, but it just wasn't I guess it wasn't very immediate for me. And then I did take a slightly different turn the more I listened to it. I was trying to find little snippets, and I think I was just really holding on to bits. So the songs I like 4 out of 5, stands out. But then I'm thinking, if that was in AM to me, that's not getting in the album, like, for me personally, because it's like a, you know. But I don't know, I feel I compare it to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood by Quentin Tarantino. Like, it's one of the films, it's a good film, but Tarantino relied on that film for people to know what Tarantino is like. Tarantino builds suspense and tenseness in his films. Yeah. So there's a lot of scenes where you're waiting for that to happen and it doesn't happen. He's like relying on his reputation because he knows that the people watching this film like Tarantino, and Arctic Monkeys knew that the people listening to this album like Arctic Monkeys. And I feel like that was the first time they relied on that. But I still respect it massively for going in that direction, but it just wasn't one for me. And I have tried listening to it a lot. Still, One Point Perspective is still one of my favorite Arctic Monkeys songs ever, which I still love. Yeah. So there's snippets in there, for sure.
Good day to you, Tranquility Base. MLT podcast special, Mark speaking. Please tell me which side of the fence that you fall after the tone.
Hi, I'm Mike, and based in Leytonstone, East London. Definitely a lover of this album. Where things have become more isolationist in the last year, I think it's the perfect album to listen to during lockdown and the Descent into Madness. And it's really hard to get past the opening track on this album, as definitely my favourite track, has all the best lines in it. Maybe I was a little too wild in the 70s. It's a fantastic opener. I can remember hearing it and just going, this is great. They've gone in this completely different direction. I feel like I've listened to this more over the past year than any other record. You really get that sense that definitely Mr. Turner went round the bend a bit, even to the amount of detail he goes into with that weird little model that he has spinning around in the videos. I mean, I'm interested to see what direction they're going next. Maybe they'll go in a sort of, I feel like a lot of the band were held back on this album to a certain extent, so I hope that Matt Helders gets his the King of Limbs style percussive album where he gets to take the lead, because I'm sure part of him, or he wants to be the eight-armed beast that there is on Favourite Worst Nightmare. This record is so special to me in that it's the idea of having a concept album of a lounge act in a bar on the moon. It has a lot of it really was the best sort of the best way in which to really challenge fans of Arctic Monkeys. I said when this album came out, it would separate the shit munchers from people who really enjoy good music. And this definitely was a polarizer, but for me, one of the best albums of the last, definitely of the last 5 years.
I was looking at the listing for NME, and I think the tracks they're sort of all over the place in terms of the ranking, as in, I think you got Star Treatment in the top 10, and there's a couple of others in the top 20. Yeah. I mean, where does this fall in terms of like your maybe album placing, do you think?
I think on a personal level, it would be my favourite due to, I think, the time and the memories associated with it. Like I explained earlier, obviously really investing in that fandom. But then arguably, I think, even taking that side of it away, it probably is my favourite Arctic Monkeys album. I just think coming off the back of the success of AM, which was a blockbuster success, songs that have surplus of a billion streams on Spotify, right? Yeah. They could have very easily followed that formula, made an AM 2.0, and we'd all be happy. But to kind of use their, like you said, reputation and really challenge the listeners and take us somewhere where we really wouldn't have expected from them before. I think that just kind of reaffirmed my love for the band, like never knowing what to expect from them. And I guess from now they could go anywhere. Yeah. I don't even know how to imagine what the next album will sound like, really.
Totally.
Yeah. Because I don't want people to think like I hate it and that's it. It's more the fact that I am a massive Arctic Monkeys fans, and I think they full well, no matter what I think of it and other people that don't like it, they have fully deserved they've deserved that to actually do what they want and just literally do anything. And so because of how good they are. So that's the most important thing. But yeah,
I think that's almost like, you know, a key place to start the conversation, really, because I think, first of all, following up AM is almost an impossible task to really satisfy everybody. I mean, it sold 157,000 units in the UK on week one. Yes, I do have these stats written down. Climb the top spot in multiple countries. It cracked the US really finally on AM as well. They got the top 10 on the Billboard charts. So, and it seemed like in the UK as well, they sort of outrun that shadow cast by the debut album. I think I heard them talking about when they played Glastonbury, they finally put a lot of songs from the first album into their set, but they felt the reception wasn't as warm as they thought it would be. So people were more, you know, they had more appetite for the AM songs, basically, whereas you don't usually get two albums like that in a career where everybody wants to hear the songs from that particular album, because you always obviously have these people saying, oh yeah, they're not like they used to be, but, you know, which sort of annoys me because they've made so much great stuff since then. They'll just end up on that indie sort of landfill. They just carried on doing the same thing over and over again. So I think, yeah, it's sort of impossible to follow AM. I think obviously he had the last Shadow Puppets, which I think for him is a bit of a holiday and a distraction. Were you into that second Last Shadow Puppets album, Sophie?
Hugely. I think I even preferred it to the first one. It felt even more cinematic than that first one, and that was the first time I obviously kind of got to see Alex live as well. So yeah, very special album.
Yeah,
to me.
He seemed like he was really on that record, as in like just being super strange on stage. But it's probably because like he had that mounting pressure of like, what are you gonna do after AM, and where are you gonna take it? I think
it's like what you said there. It just felt like a bit of a freedom and release for him. Really, because obviously at that point it'd been 3 years since AM, there'd been no word of them at all. The tour had finished 2 years ago, so yeah, it was building up and up and up, and yeah, there was kind of a side to Alex I don't think we'd seen previously there.
totally.
That Shadow Puppets album was insane, to be fair. I actually loved that. I put it on the other day when I was, I think, driving to Essex on the weekend. It was just so good. You forget how good that album is. Yeah. It's not something I put on a lot, like out of choice. I don't know why, but I need to more, because I never got to see Last Shadow Puppets live, annoyingly. I was close to booking a ticket, but something came up. But that's one of my regrets.
Yeah.
Hopefully in the future.
Yeah, I think, yeah, the sound is sort of like quite luxurious when I've like listened back to it. It sounds very rich and summery. Yeah, I really like have a lot of time for that album, for sure. Because I was sort of thinking, you know, the fact it's sort of quite a hard sell, the concept that it's on this hotel complex on the moon's surface, and obviously Tranquility Base being the site of the moon landing. And well, I think, you know, there's some songs that seem like they're in a specific location. So Star Treatment refers to like the make believe residency. American Sports, he's looking at Earth from outer space, and then 4 out of 5, he's got the Takaria on the moon. And I think I recall him talking about having some exhaustion with writing love songs. I don't know if you recall that, Sophie, Saul, which is obviously a lot of the music up until that point was certainly on AM and everything you come to expect. And he's, you know, within 2016 to 2018, obviously big political time, and you can't see him writing a straight up political record. But I think I find it's quite a clever concept, because it's almost like he's created this fictionalized world, but he's able to talk about what's actually going on day to day in such a different way. He's sort of like flipped that on its head in a way. that's not really a question, but but yeah, does that sort of resonate with you as well? Like, did you read into much around the concept at all?
Yeah, definitely. And I kind of really like the element as well of how we use these grand metaphors to kind of cover over how a few of the tracks talk about his youth and how he kind of sees his fame as well. Obviously, the most stark example being Star Treatment.
Yeah.
I just want to be one of the jokes. But yeah, just having this really sort of... sorry, I'm going off on a tangent.
Right, go for it.
Having these really sort of surreal... layers made it quite challenging as a listener as well to really get to the root of it. I mean, on AM, a lot of the sort of stories are quite plain spoken there, like you said about the love songs and stuff. So to be hit with this was a challenge as a listener and a fan. But yeah, I think, to be honest, you described the concept there far better than I could.
Because I think the thing that fascinates me quite a lot, especially because Star Treatment is probably one of my favorite Arctic Monkeys songs ever, but yeah. I think it's almost the him writing through the writer's block he had, or not knowing where to start, because I know he definitely had that period until, and there's a story about him getting a piano for his 30th birthday, I think, from his manager, and him sort of not having any ideas before getting onto the piano. But I think it's just such a dense song, that, and it's something that I can keep going back to, because you pick up on different things, you know, every time you go back. And, you know, particularly like the line around Golden Boy is in bad shape, and I know that's from a Leonard Cohen song. It's like you can read into the... I think the issue is that obviously it's such a dense listen. Most people who were really into AM, or maybe just got into Arctic Monkeys off of AM, listen to it and it sort of lived and died there for them. Do you know what I mean? They were just like, I can't get into this anymore. But I found I can just go back to it and keep getting more from it every time, you know, I return.
To be honest, I think I probably am one of those people you describe in terms of it died there and then on my first listen. But I gave it a few more listens as well. But I was almost also on the side of being like, look, they don't... I personally feel like the music in this album doesn't deserve my attention to like look into further and notice these little things.
Right.
So I was like, you know what? It's not for me. I probably did decide that quite early, but I need that kind of, I don't need to necessarily like immediately love something, but I need to be pulled in by something. And it just didn't quite have it. One Point Perspective, like I said, like, and Star Treatment, I thought it started quite well, but yeah, it just didn't quite do it for me. But I do think I'm probably one of those. So that makes you sound like a really temporary fan, but I'm not.
Yeah,
I think it's quite important to remember as well that a bit of the controversy came from the fact that obviously with AM, essentially a new generation of Arctic Monkeys fans were born. It was such a big album on the social media circles in terms of Tumblr. The aesthetic of the album drew in a whole new range of fans, many of them being international as well. So that was their gateway into Arctic Monkeys. And then to be thrown with something like this, like you said, there's not the immediacy on the first listen. It died right there and then. And that's why perhaps AM continues to be such a great success. It's still going around in those Tumblr circles today.
Totally.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Did you enjoy the approach to the lyrics yourself, Sophie, as in did you like the sort of sci-fi angle on everything opposed to what came before?
Yeah, definitely. I kind of count myself as a lyrics over melody person. Yeah. A lot of my favourite artists, like for example, like you said earlier, I'm a huge Father John Misty fan. So even if I don't quite understand what they're on about on the first listen, I like being challenged and I like having those really like wordy puzzles to work out. I mean, after the album came out, I tried to do a little bit of wider reading and look into his influences. I know one of those was a film called 8½. It's a surrealist film by an Italian director called Federico Fellini. Yeah. And in that film, it's quite a self-reflective thing where the sort of protagonist talks a lot about his own writer's block, his memories of youth, and sort of looking into a science fiction future. And a lot of those themes came up on Tranquility Base. I think once I started to do that wider reading and looking beyond the album, I kind of understood it a little bit more, but it's still nice to go back and find new elements every time or learn new things about it. I like how it continues to challenge me, really, and that's probably helped with my writing in a way.
That's annoying because I could tell you're good at your job because even I've started to question it. I'm like, fuck's sake, Sophie, why?
I'm a good sales person, especially when it comes to Arctic Monkeys. I can make anyone happy.
We'll get you back on like the next Arctic's album in like 2 years, and I'll just be like, yeah, I think Tranquility is probably my favorite. From there, who knows?
Finally seeing the light.
Exactly.
No, it's a good point. I appreciate all these extra details that you say about the film, the Italian director, and that sounds really cool. And I genuinely want to read into stuff like that. So I don't know. Maybe there's hope, Sean.
You never know. Yeah. You never know. Because I was going to ask you about whether you've done any wider reading or wider watch. I haven't actually seen any of the films, but he seems like he's quite drawn to these things that almost peel back the curtain on the writer's process, which obviously fed right into Star Treatment as well. But I've read a few years ago The Amusing Ourselves to Death, which is a Neil Postman book.
I was just about to mention that myself. Yeah.
What were your thoughts on that bit? Did you read that after hearing about it in Tranquility Base?
Yeah, there was actually a really good NME article that came out the same week that kind of signposted all of these influences, and the Neil Postman book was mentioned in there. So yeah, I kind of took off my own accord to kind of find it and read it, whereas at the time I should have really been studying for my A-level exams. I was so embedded in the album that was truly more important to me. But yeah, I liked kind of the reflections it had on how we consume our knowledge from media, particularly TV and radio, and that's something that's definitely reflected in songs such as American Sports and Star Treatment. So it definitely kind of gave me greater insight into the album and helped me understand it a little bit more, because like I said, it was such an overwhelming thing, not only as a fan, but as a listener, to be hit with such heavy songs like
totally.
That.
Because, it's worth noting as well, that book particularly, it came out in 1985, I think it came out, and essentially it forecasts a lot of what we're seeing today within the reduction of attention span and how entertainment plays a role in our everyday life. And it's obviously where that phrase, the information action ratio, is pinched from, which is essentially the information that people absorb and what they actually do with it. That's right, isn't it, Soph? I call you Soph. Yeah. I always shorten people's names. Is it all right if I call you Soph?
It's fine. As long as it's not Sophia.
It's because you call my Sophie.
Yeah,
Soph.
Neil's fiance now is Soph. what was I saying there?
Just a load of shit.
Oh, yeah, I thought so. Oh, yeah, information and action ratio, that's it. Which is obviously the name of the Takeria. I think that's probably why some people get puzzled with it, because there's so many, even that saying the information action ratio is the name of a taqueria that he's put on a fictional place on the moon. That's why it's so, you can spend so much time going into the sort of, the DNA of it. It's crazy, which I think really probably went over, it would go over anybody's head if they had only listened to it once or twice around, I think. But what was your reaction to it? I mean, I assume it seems like it was positive. Was that a mutual thing shared by friends and other people around you at the time? What do you remember about that time?
It was quite mixed. I mean, as aforementioned, the album was leaked, so I had friends kind of messaging me saying, you're not going to believe what this sounds like any expectations you have, throw it out the window. They were just trying to tell me how outlandish it was and were kind of giving me a little bit of a warning. I mean, it was quite funny on Twitter as well. I mean, the night it came out, I remember NME did a listening party and the hashtag was something like Monkey's Party, and me being me, an overly obsessed fan, got a bit overexcited and I put out a tweet like, oh, this is their masterpiece, like I can't believe what this sounds like. And I remember the NME account retweeted it, and then I just got hounded by like random dark Twitter guy is being like, you need to sort your hearing out and this and that. So yeah, I mean, I think a lot of friends weren't as into it as I was. So yeah, it was quite difficult. But I mean, like the year prior, we had Father John Misty's Pure Comedy, another album that's really political, really heavy. And I was so into that and really took the time to unpick that that I didn't mind going through the sort of same process again. Yeah. So, I mean, not everyone's going to have that amount of time and patience, but you know.
See, that's a good example, Pure Comedy. I was like, I'm saying, I have to be drawn. Pure Comedy for me was immediate for me. I don't know why. I just really grasped it. I think I only recently just got into Father John Misty at the time. So that was almost one of the, other than like Honey Bear and stuff, a few tracks. The first album I proper listened to was that. But I was really into that album. But it's just, that just really gravitated like me at the time.
I think that Pure Comedy is real sort of heavy. I'm sort of looking forward to what he comes out with next as well, because he's taking, it felt like Father John needs to take a little bit of a break, because he brought out about four albums in like only a handful of years really, so I think whatever he does next will be really interesting.
Good day to you, Tranquility Base, MLT Podcast Special, Mark speaking. Please tell me which side of the fence that you fall after the tone.
Good morning, my name is Richard Sturges and I'm based in South London. I guess you'd say I'm more of a hater of Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino. Why, you ask? Well, mainly due to Alex Turner's vocal performance on the album. Instrumentation wise, I thought the album was pretty good actually. Loads of new stars in there that I quite enjoyed. But for me, Alex Turner's voice and vocal performance is kind of the glue that sticks all the albums together. And yeah, this one just kind of fell apart as I was listening to it and I just switched off from it. Least favourite track is probably the title track, mainly where he says, he sings, oh, what is it, a good afternoon, or something like that. He sounds like an owl or a ghost. Hopes for the next album, I guess, for Alex Turner to sound more like himself, rather than sounding like he's trying to be someone else, or like he's doing a cover of himself.
Did you get to see him live on that run at all, Sophie?
No, I did four shows. So
four shows, nice. Wow.
Essentially, I'd saved all my money from my retail job at a record store when I was 16, 17, and I was really lucky to be able to go to the Royal Albert Hall show as well, which obviously that was a live album last year.
Amazing.
Yeah, that was really overwhelming. Obviously, being at their first kind of UK show in 4 years. They played From the Ritz to the Rebel for the first time in 7 years. It was the live debut of Star Treatment. So kind of everything you could dream for as a diehard fan happened that night. It was really, really surreal.
At the Royal Albert Hall as well. Everything sounds beautiful. Amazing in that room. Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of felt like all the years of being a bit of a Die Hard stand kind of paid off in that one night. So I just got everything I could have asked of. Yeah, I saw them there. I also went to Budapest to see them headline the Get Festival.
Oh, wow.
Which was incredible. And then did the O2 and a night in Birmingham as well when they did the UK tour in the September. So yeah, I was very, very lucky.
Nice. I saw them at Primavera, which was amazing. I thought the first time I've been to a festival abroad, and I felt like the Spanish crowd were really passionate,
because
sometimes in the UK people can be a little bit hopefully when it comes back people have some more energy for it, but there are a few gigs I've been to where it just has been a bit more like downbeat, especially in London maybe. I think
we're so reserved, we're too worried about what people think sometimes, but at gig anything goes, man.
No, exactly.
It's just a British way in general though, isn't it? Just sometimes you're a bit like, looking around. Whereas I've heard, I think it was an interview with Vault J ages ago, and they were talking about they love playing, at first when they were playing in Japan, they thought, they're playing a Japanese festival, and they thought they were just being rude because they didn't clap or anything, or just no noise, but they looked, they were just, had their eyes closed, just taking in every second of music,
yeah,
just living it in their head, and just so deep within it. They were like, it's a really odd gig, but it's a really like refreshing experience. But
yeah, totally. Yeah, it's sort of, but I think, yeah, that Primavera set was, I think it got quite tepid reviews, but from where I was, it was really great. I really enjoyed it. And obviously that was like their first big festival comeback show.
Yeah.
And, you know, they obviously dropping like these weird Tranquility songs in the mix and everything, which, but I thought they came over really well, live particularly. And then we went to the O2 Arena gig, me and Neil, which I presume was the same one that you were at as well. And I think we went on the Sunday, and I don't know what it was, but there's something about the vibe. I feel maybe people weren't up for it because they had like just eaten like a roast dinner and they got work tomorrow or something.
It was lacking, wasn't it? It really was.
Yeah. I mean, it was still enjoyable, but there was, it wasn't like that the best time I've seen him.
No, I think the O2 was actually one of my favourites, to be honest. But once again, it might be on a personal level, kind of being down the front, finally, like close to the band that I've admired for years. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
yeah, they probably didn't play as well as they did at Royal Albert Hall, for example. There's probably all that energy of coming back for the first UK shows, whereas the O2 was quite a few gigs into the cycle. The Sheffield ones were already out of the way, so you can see what you mean there.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely. No,
where was it, Sean, when we saw them with Josh? Was it Shepherd's Bush?
That was at Earl's Court before it shut down.
That was a fantastic gig.
Yeah.
That was a quality gig.
It was the first time our mate Josh had really been to a gig aside from like a Razorlight concert back in the day.
No, it was like Take That, wasn't it? It was literally in between as well.
And there was like a little pit forming in Are You Mine? And we were just like nudging him.
Closer and closer, he loved it though.
Yeah, he proper loved it. But but yeah, I felt like overall though, I mean, particularly on that live album, you were lucky enough to be there, of course, but that I think it came over really well live. And I've gone back to that BBC session they did, and I just think it's real like quirky and cool the way that they've done it. And I really like the way they sounded, particularly those the Tranquility tracks, I think.
Especially at Royal Albert Hall, it was actually quite a surprise because at that point the album had only been out for 3.5 weeks and the tickets had gone on sale before the album was out as well. But especially when they played Star Treatment, I remember kind of hearing how loud the crowd was when they were singing back the chorus, and even those verses, which are kind of a stream of consciousness. So it was kind of unbelievable to see that they were having this reaction when online it'd been so polarizing. I kind of went in thinking, right, this crowd may not be as invested as me, for example. But it was quite moving, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. That's pretty cool.
It's not exactly like the most melodic thing just to call and response. It's sort of like, like you say, just a stream of consciousness. But it's impressive that, you know, they've got the love there from the fans that, you know, that sort of thing will happen.
With the live shows, I think they revealed kind of even more influences to the album. The kind of pre-show playlist had a lot of tracks from French New Wave films on there. There was a lot of Ennio Morricone stuff as well. So I think if people were paying attention to what they were playing before the shows, a lot of those songs, I mean, being stood in the crowd at the time, I was thinking, this sounds melodically like a few of the tracks on the album. And once again, it makes sense. I think there was quite a few occasions around that album cycle where they were perhaps quite subtle with the influences for it. And you really had to kind of do that wider reading and really listen out for things. And then it kind of all added up and made sense.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I love that.
That's interesting. Yeah,
because I think he was also talking about in those the films. I think there was one called Le Cercle Rouge and Le Samurai. He was talking about, and he was saying that there was this sort of jazzy lounge, these jazzy lounge scenes, and he almost wrote the music for those interiors, which is such an interesting way of trying to piece together, you know, a new world, really, because that's, I think it comes down to the fact that really he had to build a new world for him to inhabit, to be able to actually write anything, because his world had probably become so almost, you know, you're living in LA and, you know, in the sunshine every day or whatever. It is probably, you probably do need to create the sort of laws of your own universe and try and occupy that to write something, which is something that, yeah, I feel like he really occupied there.
Good day to you, Tranquility Base, MLT Podcast Special, Mark speaking. Please tell me which side of the fence that you fall after the tone.
I'm Brad, I'm based in London. Absolutely love Tranquility Base. It's my favourite album of theirs. I think it's the best thing they've ever done, or certainly the best thing since the first album. I just think the reason for that is because lyrically, it's as close to the first album that they've come, and musically, it's incredibly different to anything they've done before, and they really successfully pull off that change of style and the whole concept album structure. My favourite track is Bat Phone. I think it's another classic crooning Alex Turner number that he pulls off really well. And in terms of the next album, I don't really know where you go from the space band moon concept. So I guess we'll have to just wait and see.
It's weird to think where they go next, because I wonder if they have like another cycle where they sort of come back to something a little bit more mainstream, for want of a better word, or whether they really just keep building these little universes and making the most out of that. What are your thoughts, Sophie? What do you think?
I quite like this sort of thing to carry on, to be honest, and to have a really mellow, challenging listen. Like, I found myself going back to it more often than other Arctic Monkeys albums. I think especially in the past year with the pandemic, you can kind of even apply some of the lyrics on this album to what's happened. Like, there's that line on She Looks Like Fun, no one's on the streets, we moved it all online as of March.
Yeah.
Obviously completely coincidental, but it's just great to still be finding these little things and relating to them. So yeah, I would much rather have something like this where I can go in with absolutely no expectations and see where they take us next. But it's just impossible to forecast, even as someone that kind of talks all the time on Twitter about how I'm a huge fan. All the expectations I had of the last album were completely proved wrong, so I don't want to kind of big myself up again and be a bit silly, you know. But I mean, yeah, people are still talking about this album, and it was a massive success commercially. It outsold the top 20 in the UK combined in the first week, and it was recently announced that it was the fastest selling vinyl record of the 21st century. So yeah, I think they really could go anywhere from here, to repeat what I said earlier.
Yeah, I think that's the most exciting part of it, really. There really are a band, every time they bring something out, you have no idea what's coming. And I hope they do it again, when in the format where the album just comes as a whole as well. I quite like sort of just diving into it that way. What do you think, Neil? What's your predictions, man?
Not a clue. I think the whole point, like I said earlier, they've just earned the right with, if this is NFL, American football, they're in the Hall of Fame. They've earned the right to do whatever they want. And even though Tranquility didn't speak to me personally, I'm still so excited to know what they're going to do next, because that's just, it's just part of their kind of agenda. Like, it's not like it kills the band for me. You know, there's people out there being like, this just ruins the Arctic Monkeys. Like, oh, grow up.
Yeah.
It's just, but I'm just, when I actually think about, you know, the idea of having an album by Arctic Monkeys to look forward to, I just smile. Like, I actually can't wait. I really have no idea. I reckon I'll go into some sort of, like, I can see like a disco-y angle. I don't know why, but I could just see it. But
yeah, just something a bit more funky.
Alex bringing out some funky moves. Yeah, I'd love to see like a funky album. But who knows? They've earned the right to do what the fuck they want. So yeah, it's exciting.
I think anyone that said they hated the last album as well is still going to be intrigued by what they do.
Yeah, 100%.
That's the thing. Even if it's not a good taste, you're still going to want to know where they're going to go, because it's just left. It's so unpredictable. And
yeah,
that's one of the many reasons I think I love them.
Totally, totally. Being a deep fan of the Arctic Monkeys, do you have any like idea of what's going on in the camp? Are they recording? From what I know, they're in different parts of the world and they can't record yet or anything. Is that what you've heard as well?
Yeah, I mean, there was something on Instagram a couple of weeks ago where I think it was Matt Helder's story was kind of posted of a drum setup, and then one of their longtime producers tagged them in a post of a studio as well in LA. So
right.
There's kind of been rumours flying around that they're recording at the moment. But, I mean, even with the last album, this was going on for a good 3-4 years until we had a final word. It took for Nick O'Malley, in an interview with a motorbike magazine, out of anyone he could have possibly told, to say, we're recording, and if it's not an album by the end of the next year, there's problems.
Yeah.
So, because they're not active on social media or anything, it's so hard to try and keep track and...
Yeah.
Yeah, but fingers crossed.
Are you quite embedded in like the fan community?
In bits. I mean, there's obviously the Arctic Monkeys US forum. I don't have an account on there, but I do read quite often just to kind of check up with rumours and stuff. And there's a lot of Stan accounts on Twitter who kind of make me laugh with their like Alex Turner fan cams and edits. So I think I'm more of a observer than actively participating. I don't know. I think sort of my idea of Arctic Monkeys fandom has always been so personal to me and kind of insular, in the sense that it's just been through reading magazine features and collecting them that I think I only go as far as kind of joking about how ridiculous I am on Twitter.
I'm just glad that, like, you know, you've justified. I was worried that, like, when I hear people who love Tranquility, sometimes I feel like, is it because they're just so obsessed with Arctic Monkeys that they could just literally, like, I don't know, just go on stage, just cough, and then that's like the genius thing about Alex Turner? Or whereas you've come here and you've justified 100% why you've talked about these, like, just all these extra research that you've got to do around the back to really understand it. So that's what I was kind of worried. I was like, is she going to just be like really biased because she like loves Arctic Monkeys? But you've actually justified why, and that's kind of like, yeah, I do like that. Yeah. I'm probably going to go away and do some bloody research now.
Oh, you're going to love it.
I know. So I'll send a text to Sean and be like, let Sophie know that I'm hooked.
My work is done. it was even tricky with that NME article. I mean, I had to take my personal bias away from the ranking and kind of think about these songs in context.
Yeah.
Like, I bet you Good on the Dance Floor, for example, probably wouldn't be my personal number two, but you have to think about the impact that it had when it came out in the MySpace era and get that context into your copy. So I think I've really had to learn, especially kind of making ways into my job, how to take personal bias out of my writing and my work.
I'm glad you said that, because when I was reading this, I was like, okay, interesting. Like, because it's hard because you're like, I'm like, am I reading this from like her point of view, or is it like, you do have to kind of take it into account, whereas it's sometimes what it meant, isn't it? Like, it's obviously huge. It's the one they play on like, if you're out at, like, just even like in a club or something, if you're gonna play a song, they'll play it. I bet you look good on the dance floor. But it's probably the one that fans probably don't like to hear as much because it's so done, isn't it? But like, imagine if you're in a club and they just played From the Ritz to the Rubble or something, you'd lose your absolute shit. But then the other half of the club would just be like, what the fuck is this? So got to play to the masses sometimes.
Yeah.
Years of research in their history was applied to that one article, essentially.
I bet. Yeah, I bet.
I remember the one time I got active in the fan community was, I think it was around AM. And it was the sort of thing where I think I was at uni at the time, had nothing better to do really apart from write essays that probably would have actually helped. But I was just literally researching Arctic Monkeys every day, and I found some link on some French website, and I was like, do you know what, I'll throw this on the forum because someone will know how to get access to it. And it was like, why do you only call me when you hired a single? And then I remember I put it on the thing, I was like, oh, can anybody get this like as an audio like cut or something? And people started going mad, thinking I was like somebody inside the band or something, because my tag name was Coffee Pot. I just see all these people going like, "Who the hell is Coffee Pot? Is it Alex Zen or something?" So I just like reveled in that for a few days.
Who the hell is Coffee Pot? I can imagine you like being in a future interview, but like, you may have referred to me as Coffee Pot from back in the day. I'm the one who leaked the album.
I think I revived Coffee Pot as my own sort of pseudonym.
There's a lot of kind of gatekeeping in that fandom as well, like people that have particularly been there since the early days with singles like Bang Bang and things like that. So obviously coming in and writing this article when I was like, what, 5 years old when the debut album came out? I had a lot of backlash for that as well, but I mean, I dedicated that time to learning about them, so I think I'm kind of equal.
Exactly, put in the hours. That's it.
Put in the shifts.
Awesome. Thanks so much for joining us, Sophie. Real great having you on, your Arctic Monkeys insight. Yeah. And like Neil said, whenever they drop an album, we'll have to get you back on and talk about it. That would be awesome if you're up for it.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
So, Neil, good chat. Seems like you we're gonna have to keep us posted whether you have gone back to Tranquility Base or not.
I will do. It's not top of my list whilst Olivia's like literally haunting my playlists. But maybe I will. But Sophie did a good job at twisting my arm and certainly offered a lot more insight and deeper understanding on the album than I'd ever kind of care to give it a chance to be honest.
Yeah, definitely. Well, keep us posted on your on the progress there.
I will.
So yeah, that's episode 1 of season 3. Stay tuned for more episodes in the coming weeks, and we will catch you on the next one. Ciao ciao for now.
Goodbye.